I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what happened this week? It seemed to go by in a flash. Today, President Obama turns his attention back to the economy with a lightning-quick visit to Ohio to break ground for the 10,000th road project spawned by the stimulus bill. But he began the week with that overnight in the Gulf, and as oil subsumes that region, it has also taken over the agenda in Washington. To help us take stock of the week past and look to the one ahead, we're joined by Rick Klein, Senior Washington News Editor for ABC World News and also host to the network's political webcast Top Line. Rick, overall, politically, what kind of week do you think it was for Obama?
I think this is probably the most encouraging week the White House has had in several months, maybe since the beginning of the oil crisis. I think finally you had an opportunity for him to show that he was getting back on the side of the American people. You had him establishing this new trust fund that BP put in. He had his Oval Office address. And then I think that incredible moment where you had a Republican congressman get up there and apologize to BP. The fact that that was a major headline from Joe Barton, a Republican congressman from Texas, the top Republican on the Energy Committee, was a tailor-made political moment for the White House and for Democrats. They could not have been happier about that.
Well, let's talk about this. This was at yesterday's congressional hearings. He apologized to BP CEO Tony Hayward for the White House asking BP to contribute to this compensation fund. But then he had to come out a few hours later and apologize for his apology. What was going on there? Was that the Republican leadership reacting?
Yes, it set off a firestorm of criticism from Democrats and Republicans, and top members of Republican leadership even said, look, we're not going to be able to stand behind you if you don't go out there and apologize. That is not the message they needed out there. So you had this spectacle of, this high-ranking Republican apologizing for his apology, and that is rarely good, and no one really wants to be on BP's side in this, and that's what a Republican member of Congress did, and that's why the White House pounced.
Well, but will Joe Barton's comment help Democrats on the larger issue of the size and reach of the Obama administration? David Sanger is writing in the New York Times today that the White House does want to make this a central issue in elections this November, the idea that government has a role.
That's right, and he does play into that as a danger in setting up this fund and having the government step in a big way. But you also get the sense that this is a time where people want to see the government hold BP accountable. That's the White House calculation. I think the point that Mr. Sanger and others are making, though, is that there's been so many crises that President Obama seems to have solved by turning to government. Republicans like that, but I think they can put it a lot more articulately than by apologizing to the chairman of BP.
In other words, from health care to auto and banking industry bailouts, and now this relationship between the government and BP, do you think, despite Barton's misstep, the Republicans will make hay out of that?
They will, and that's going to be a theme of the elections. But it's tough to be on the side of the company that's still dumping, you know, tens of thousands of gallons and barrels of oil into the Gulf every day.
Well, and this is a very fluid story. The president may, in your opinion, have had a good week this week, but who knows what happens as the disaster continues in the Gulf. And right now, the Rasmussen overnight tracking poll shows 58% of Americans disapprove of the president's overall performance. 41% say they somewhat approve. Rasmussen is said to be a poll tied to the Republican Party, but still there's that. And then separately, an ABC poll shows that the unfavorable view of the Tea Party has increased. Candidates like Rand Paul and Sharon Angle may be winning elections, but some of the things they're saying may be turning people off.
Yes, that's right, and it's a danger for the Tea Party movement. Obviously, you have people that pushing the party rightward and espousing some positions that are not particularly popular with the mainstream in the party. That's an issue, and it's something they're going to have to be careful about. We're seeing this happen in a couple of states now. Democrats are happy about the fact that they're going to run against some folks who take positions that it's hard to sell as mainstream. On the other hand, you can make an argument for the Republicans and say, look, these are political outsiders. This is exactly the kind of candidate you need in a year like this.
Well, Rand Paul in particular showing sympathy again to BP. Rick Klein, so what else jumps out at you from this past week, and what are you looking at next week?
You know, one thing I think that we're seeing develop is a sense of sticker shock from Democrats about any new spending programs. President Obama over the weekend, last weekend, said we need another $20 billion plus to make sure the teachers don't get laid off, aid to states. In addition to that, long-term unemployment benefits have expired. President Obama wants both of those things passed. But we're seeing opposition, particularly in the Senate, from Democrats, moderate Democrats, who say, you know, enough of the new spending. That's, to me, a pretty significant shift in the politics of Congress, and that has big implications.
Quick thoughts about next week?
a couple of big things are going to be happening. One is this new push on spending, and I think that is going to dominate a lot of the headlines. We're beginning to see now the president sell the stimulus program and try to turn that back into a political advantage. As we move beyond maybe talking about the oil spill every day, we're seeing these issues emerge and begin to crystallize for the fall.
Rick Klein, senior Washington News editor for ABC World News and host of the network's political webcast, Top Line. Rick, thanks as always.
Hey, thank you.
Well, the analysis phase is in full swing. People trying to figure out what can we learn from the response to the Gulf oil disaster. Yes, the federal government was on the scene the day of the blowout, but no one knew who was in charge. Yes, BP hired contractors, but those contractors often sat idle. Early on, shrimpers took matters in their own hands and began laying out boom. Alabama scoured the world for boom, only to watch it sent to Louisiana by the Coast Guard. BP's response plan listed walruses. There are none in the Gulf. Just last night, ABC News reported 16 barges that the governor of Louisiana ordered to vacuum oil out of coastal waters sat idle because the Coast Guard needed to confirm there were fire extinguishers and life vests on board. This just happened yesterday, and those barges finally got the go-ahead. So this week, the Wall Street Journal took a step-by-step look at the Gulf disaster response. We want to go deeper into that today with Jeffrey Ball, environment editor for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Cake Mix Recording Studios in Dallas. Jeffrey, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Robin.
And what is your overarching find?
Well, the basic find is threefold. First, no one anticipated an oil spill this large and this complex and this long-lasting. Second, the plans that both BP and the federal government had on the books prior to this spill didn't anticipate it and therefore didn't lay out a clear way to deal with it. And lastly, there have been problems with the response, a kind of lack of communication born of not having anticipated something like this.
Well, Jeff, first of all, I have to say, we have sworn off use of the word spill because it's such a gusher at this point. So for our listeners who continually write us about that, we just want to note that, and we will later in the program. But also, let's just take a look at one of those issues which seems to be the one that is so resounding. People didn't know who's in charge, and the communication was so confusing. You write about the Alabama oil booms, terrific reporting about how Alabama scours the world for these special booms because they see what's happening in Louisiana. The booms arrive, and then Alabama watches as they go to Louisiana?
Right. So we should explain what booms are. Boom are these pipes that everyone has probably seen in photos that are laid across the coast, along the coast, to try to prevent oil from coming ashore. And there have been lots of problems with them, among them that waves wash the oil over under the boom. But what you're referring to is a problem where, given that there hasn't been enough boom available to lay across the hundreds of miles of coastline, there's had to be triage and sort of constant moving of this boom around, which has really infuriated a lot of people in states and local areas. And what you're referring to is that boom was acquired by Alabama. Alabama officials actually flew boom in from Bahrain, believe it or not. Mm. This was special ocean boom, large boom that they thought was going to be particularly protective. And then the federal government moved that boom elsewhere to Louisiana. And what the federal government says is that the reason it's done that is that this is, as you say, it's not a conventional spill. This is constantly moving,
right,
and they're therefore moving stuff around to try to fight it. But the people in Alabama who thought that the boom was for them are incensed by that.
Well, but see, this raised a question for us, Jeff, because, people complaining that no one's in charge, governors in particular, but in that case, someone was in charge. I mean, the government obviously made this decision whether or not the states liked it. So that was confusing to us because it seemed as if sometimes people were complaining about who was in charge when they didn't like what the federal government said.
Yeah, well, we should explain here, there's a very complicated system here for running an oil spill like this. But what the federal law makes clear is that in a spill that's this serious, the feds do run the show. And in this case, BP is executing a lot of the daily tactics. But at the end of the day, the federal government approves or disapproves of those and makes the final decisions. The reality has been that under that rubric of federal control, you have BP and you have various state and local decisions. And frankly, all of those local and state officials have their own political concerns to worry about. Right. And so a lot of what's going on is people trying to answer to different constituencies in this massive spill.
Well, but did the federal government – let's stay there for a second, because did the federal government not get in charge soon enough? Because you write, yes, the White House was active from day one. And in fact, terrific observations. Interior Department Deputy Secretary David Hayes flying so fast to the Gulf that he had no underwear. The White House science advisor in the first few days pulling people aside when they heard that oil was escaping, asking about what secret technology the government had. You know, did they have a submarine? And finding out, of course, the government doesn't have a submarine. But Coast Guard Commandant Thad Allen, who was also there from, you know, practically day one, said he knew right away the spill would be serious, but he didn't say as much publicly. So the government didn't take over. He wasn't, quote, in charge till May 1st, days after. Was the government late in taking over?
Well, there was a subordinate of Thad Allen who was in charge. The government clearly was in charge early on. That is, at least officially, the government was in charge. But what seems pretty clear is that it took people a while to realize the gravity of this thing. The other thing is that this was, again, a spill, rightly or wrongly, that was not anticipated. And when people thought that they had a hold on where this spill was going, they were constantly surprised by the movement of the oil out at sea. People thought they knew where this oil was going, and then the next day they'd be surprised that the oil was going somewhere else. And they were constantly trying to shift what in the end was an inadequate supply of resources around here. And it's a massive, massive undertaking. But again, Thad Allen now admits that these plans didn't anticipate a spill like this, and he has made some recommendations for what to do about that.
Well, we want to hear about that. But first, you know, is part of that, why didn't they know? We know that after the Oil Pollution Act that followed the Exxon Valdez spill, every region was supposed to have a contingency plan. But you talked to people who said, you know, the problem, and we've heard this before, is that the government and the agencies involved just allowed the oil companies to say how they would deal with it. You know, is there a suggestion that perhaps a government scientist — this is an administration that embraces science — is there a suggestion that perhaps the government should also be saying, no, we think there's a possibility for a much bigger blowout?
Well, let me – it's really interesting, actually, to take a look at what the requirements are for these plans. The federal law prior to this spill required that oil companies who were drilling offshore file a plan for what was called a worst-case discharge, and that plan, according to federal law, would have to detail how the oil companies would manage a discharge at that level that continued for a full 30 days. BP's plan talked about managing a worst-case discharge of 250,000 barrels a day. And if you multiply 250,000 barrels a day times 30 days, even at the latest heightened estimates of this spill, you get more oil than in this spill. So the plan envisioned dealing with a spill bigger than this. Obviously, it's been tougher than the plan envisioned.
Well, and we want to know more about that, and also what Thad Allen is saying should happen going forward. More about how the states responded, the mistrust they had of federal agencies, how they duplicate each other's work just because they didn't trust each other. That's Jeff Ball, environment editor of The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back with more from him. What can we learn from government, state, BP, Coast Guard response to the disaster in the Gulf? In 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Jeffrey Ball, environment editor for The Wall Street Journal. He's done an extensive look at what can be learned from the emergency response in the Gulf of Mexico. And Jeffrey, you were talking about Coast Guard Commandant Thad Allen saying that he had some ideas as to going forward how we don't get struck again by this sense of increasing, you know, knowledge of what's going on. How can there can be more preparation and maybe what, more holding oil industry feet to the fire, holding more government agency feet to the fire in being prepared for a disaster like this?
Yeah, well, let me highlight two things that Thad Allen said actually in recent testimony on Capitol Hill that I think are really interesting. One is he said that a takeaway from this is that we simply need more of this boom as a country. We need a national strategy.
But I have to jump in there, Jeffrey. On the other hand, you have Congressman Ed Markey asking the oil companies to put more money into a fund to do new research because boom doesn't work.
Well, that's right. You know, we are at the obviously extremely early stages of learning lessons from this spill, whether one calls it a spill or not, which is obviously not over at this point. So people are flailing about trying to learn lessons here. I mean, it's absolutely clear that the boom has not worked the way that the textbooks suggested it would work. So there will be lots of ideas. But let me mention one other thing that Thad Allen said, which goes to the issue we were talking a moment ago about, which is plans. What Thad Allen said was that the plans that we were talking about, for instance, in this case, the BP plan for how it would deal with an offshore spill, was submitted to a government agency called the Minerals Management Service. Thad Allen said that he thought that there needed to be better integration between the way that the Coast Guard reviewed plans and the way the MMS reviewed plans. What he said was that the Coast Guard oversees the development of government plans, and those government plans take a more intensive look at the kind of environmental natural resources along the coast that might be hurt by an oil spill. And what he said is that the Coast Guard doesn't see the MMS review of, in this case, the BP plan. And so, therefore, it's not clear that the government is sufficiently looking at what really might be the effect of a quote-unquote worst-case spill. And if those two government agencies worked better together, then there might be more requirement that BP detail, in fact, how – and the government detail, in fact, how they would really protect some of the most fragile coastline in this country, which is along the Gulf Coast in the event of a spill.
Well, look, Jeffrey, everybody knows, and we've reported quite extensively on this, that the MMS is a mess, that the agency had been in bed with the industry, and people are talking about revamping it to make it more as it is in other countries, where the revenue gathering side, the people who gather the money from the leases to oil companies, is quite separate from the regulatory side. We know that. But is there any thinking of bringing more scientists into the process so that experts on these issues actually sign off on some of the things that the oil companies suggest?
Well, you know, the idea obviously is that people with some knowledge of this would have looked at this. I think one takeaway from this is that people are going to have to expand their horizons about what the possibility of a disaster is. You know, these plans were developed in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill, when people thought that a worst-case oil spill would be a tanker spilling its oil. It's as if it's, you know, people didn't anticipate an airplane flying into the World Trade Center either in 2001.
Well, science fiction writers did. So people debate that, but go ahead.
And so one of the things that's pretty clear is that, rightly or wrongly, a lot of people didn't think outside the box and anticipate the potential of a massive spill like this, or at least didn't do so extensively, because a lot of these plans were written with an eye toward what was sort of the historic idea of a world worst-case spill.
But, Jeffrey, you actually point out that other countries have tighter restrictions. Even states have tighter rules than federal rules. Alaska requires two vessels to escort every tanker, and Canada requires offshore drillers to have ships on standby to drill those relief wells, you know, that are needed when there's a problem. The ships are right there. And it also has timelines requiring relief wells to be drilled sooner. So there's tighter restrictions, tighter requirements around the world. The Los Angeles Times is reporting today that the American Petroleum Institute is lobbying the White House as we speak not to tighten current environmental regulations. They say the disaster in the Gulf was a one-off. But I'm wondering, as we look at other countries that have tighter restrictions, we're not getting the relief wells till maybe August. Is there a sense that we do need to tighten the requirements to raise them to at least what they are in other countries?
Well, if you listen to what's going on Capitol Hill, there's clearly discussion about tightening these regulations. I mean, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's too early to predict what we're going to do. There's clearly going to be a big fight about what we do.
Yeah.
But you know, we are as is often the case in this country, paying attention to a crisis after not having paid attention to the issue for a while. I guess it remains to be seen what happens when kind of the political sausage making ends. But that's clearly a subtext of this is do we need to tighten our regulations?
And Jeffrey, again, terrific writing today in the Wall Street Journal, outlining the response to the Gulf. But as you write, there's 1,600 National Guard troops, 31,000 emergency workers, 6,400 ships, more than 6 million feet of this boom. You know, four states. Just in the minute we have, just back to that the thing we started with, the communication. Going forward, is there an idea of having a bunker, having, you know, something so that the coordination is better?
Well, look, there are sort of command centers around the Gulf Coast that attempt to have coordination. But it's not just an issue of having people in the same room. Let me give you a really quick example here. There are really competing political interests which get into this. Laid out in these plans an idea for how much boom ought to be laid. But what quickly happened in this spill was that parish presidents in Louisiana all wanted a lot more boom than the plan suggested because they wanted to protect their particular coastline. Yeah. And what Coast Guard officials told us in the story is that had the feds been able to lay boom with a kind of more rational strategic approach as opposed to appealing to local political interests, they might have been able to do a better job of laying the boom. So I guess the takeaway is you can have your bunkers and have your plans, but the situation on the ground is never quite that neat.
Right, and people have their personal interests, and that's going to be in the battle. Jeffrey Ball, environment editor of the Wall Street Journal. I misspoke, Jeff. Your terrific article was yesterday. And we're going to link to it at our website, hereandnow.org. Jeffrey, as always, thanks so much.
Nice to be with you.
Okay. And by the way, Monday on Here and Now, another source of energy, natural gas and its environmental consequences. You want to hear about a new HBO documentary. That's Monday. Back in a minute, Here and Now. The future is anything but certain for South Carolina Democrat Alvin Green, despite last night's vote by the South Carolina Democratic Executive Committee, allowing Green to keep his astonishing victory in last week's Senate primary. You may remember Alvin Green. He's the unemployed veteran who literally came out of nowhere to win the primary. He still faces a felony obscenity charge for allegedly showing a college girl pornography. He faces an investigation by the Federal Election Commission and calls for a state examination of just how he came up with the $10,000 filing fee that he needed to get his name on the primary ballot. David Catanese is with Politico.com. And David, it was Green's Democratic opponent in the primary, a former circuit judge named Vic Rawl, who asked the Democratic committee to vote to allow a new election. They didn't last night. So how are people in South Carolina responding?
Well, I don't think this is much of a surprise. Vic Rawl assembled a team of academics after this stunning defeat that he went through, and they pointed to some voting irregularities. They said that while he won the absentee ballot, Green won election day voting patterns by a large margin, so they thought that was a discrepancy. They also said that in certain counties the votes didn't add up, but in the end, they didn't have a strong enough case. I mean, Green won this race by 30,000 votes. This was not a close election at all, so Green is the de facto nominee. He goes on to the general election.
And Rawl was claiming that the problem was unreliable electronic voting machines. As you said, Rawl got the absentee votes, but not the day of voting. He says it's the voting machines. Is there going to be any investigation of the machines?
The state has not expressed any interest in investigating this further, and the Rawl campaign actually said that they weren't going to pursue it. There's a couple factors here. Alvin Green didn't spend any money. He didn't campaign, but he had a more familiar name. This happens, and a lot of times it happens when you have two candidates on the ballot in a non-very high-profile race that no one really knows much about or is paying attention to.
Well, not only might the name Green have been sort of familiar to people, but it came higher in the alphabetical order. Now, a lot of people are saying that this is proof, finally, that people just vote for the first name that's there.
I think that it's completely validating that. I mean, we vote in a lot of elections, whether it's for judges or, you know, lower ballot races, that we probably don't have a lot of information about the candidates. So how do people vote? Well, you know, studies say, and experts would say, people vote for either a more familiar name or the first name on the ballot.
Well, what about questions about financing? As we said, candidates had to come up with a $10,000 or so filing fee to get on the ballot. There have been insinuations and flat-out accusations that this is a conspiracy by Republicans to put this, really kind of not very good candidate from the Democrats on the ballot. Has anyone asked him directly where he got that money?
Yes, he's been asked a few times in the few media interviews that he has allowed, and he basically said he raised the money through friends and supporters. I don't know if we'll ever be able to track that. There are Democrats out there with, you know, some conspiracy theories. They believe Republicans are behind this, that a Republican consultant gave him the money to allow him to do this.
Well, what about the Federal Election Commission? They're said to be starting an investigation. What would they be looking into?
They might ask some of those same questions, but again, they're going to have to probe where exactly that money came from. They'll have to look at his FEC report. They may try to question him, question people around him. Anyone who he's paid money to, they may try to bring in and ask questions. Again, though, this was such a huge victory. If Republicans encouraged him to get in the race, I'm not sure if that's a crime or not. I think that you would have to show that a bribe took place or some other criminal or nefarious activity for this to reach a higher threshold.
Well, and we just want to bring up the issue of race. It was addressed at the hearing last night. There were some people felt that blacks in the state overwhelmingly voted for him, even if they didn't know him, because the thinking was that the name Green with an E was an African-American name. But in fact, it's not. Most people in the state named Green with an E are white.
Right. And I think there was some confusion. If you speak to people down there, they actually said that African-Americans think that Green with an E is African-American name. That's why they voted for it. And you also heard that white voters thought the same thing, that they thought Green with an E on the end of a name was a white candidate. But this is the type of situation where when someone comes out of nowhere and wins, everyone's got a theory, and it's probably a combination of a lot of these factors.
Dave Catanese, Politico.com, thank you so much. We'll continue to follow this story for you. It's going to last through the fall. Back in 30 seconds, here and now.
Fakes, dribbles, puts up the three, won't go, rebound to Saul, kicks it out to Odom, Odom throws it ahead, the Lakers repeat back-to-back titles, the LA Lakers of 2000.
Oh, do we have to hear it again? Well, it was a terrific game for Celtics fans until those last few minutes. The Lakers battled back from a 13-point deficit in the second half and edged the Celtics 83-79 in a dramatic Game 7, ending a grueling series, winning the NBA championship. Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy joins us from Los Angeles. Dan, what's your headline here?
Well, I mean, they really took it as far as they could take it. I think there's no disgrace in this loss for Boston. No one expected them to be there, and it hurts a little bit when the game was so winnable.
Yeah.
Like you said, 13-point lead second half, 4-point lead start of the fourth. That stings a little bit when you realize they could have had the thing, but nobody's hanging their heads about this one.
Well, why didn't they have it? What happened in those last couple minutes there?
Well, I think the Lakers are better, generally, and you know, oh. Boston certainly missed Kendrick Perkins, and they were out-rebounded by 13. That's a lot in a game like that. The team that rebounds better won every game of this series. This was the night when the Lakers rebounded better. They had the advantage of not having Perkins down there to block out. That helped them, and neither team made shots, but you know, when you're home and you have Kobe Bryant, he's a great closer, odds are in your favor in a close game.
Yeah, Perkins went down in Game 6. He was on the sidelines in a really odd green shirt trying to root everybody on, but it just didn't work. So now you have teams that have met 12 times in the NBA Finals. The Celtics, 9 wins. Lakers now have 3. Where does the sort of the myth of the rivalry go from here, Dan?
Well, I think it is an erosion of the Boston dominance, certainly. The Celtics won this thing, you know, 7 times in the 60s. They always beat them, and they were 4-0 against them in 7th games. But in the 80s, the Larry Bird era, the Lakers beat the Celtics 2 out of 3 times when they met. And now here in this decade, it's 1-1. The Celtics beat the Lakers 2 years ago. This time went the other way. So they're really creeping up. I mean, the Lakers have 16 championships now to Boston's 18. That together they've won more than half of the NBA championships that have been handed out. And I think moving forward, it's going to be hard for the Celtics to get back to this game, whereas the Lakers look well-positioned to repeat.
Well, and the series was billed as the end of the road for what we here in Boston call the Big Three, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, maybe the last game Doc Rivers coaches. In fact, there's rumors floating around. What are you hearing in L.A. that Paul Pierce is going to L.A.?
He has an option to get out if he wants to. I don't think he would do that, but he's from Inglewood, so that's always going to be out there. But the Celtics will be dramatically changed, I believe, next year, including the coach, possibly Ray Allen, a lot of bench guys. Wallace may retire. I mean, there's going to be major changes for them, I think.
Well, and you can never count the Celtics out, as we know. But what do you think? I mean, how does the rest of the league feel about that? Are people maybe tired of the act or want it to keep going on?
Well, I think Boston, you know, they bring on a lot of jealousy, and they're trash talkers, and they've been bullies a lot of years. So I think nationally there's not too much heartache when the Celtics lose in the finals because they've won so many times, and they were never particularly gracious about it. So I don't think anybody's feeling sorry for Boston, and then they shouldn't. This is the best team I think won, and everybody did what they were supposed to do here.
Well, you say people love to hate the Celtics, but just remember, if the Celtics aren't there in the finals for you to hate, they might miss it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the rivalry was, you know, recharged this year. It was a grueling, grinding 7-game series. America basketball got what it wanted out of this, and I don't think anybody was too disappointed except for the millions of Celtic fans who saw their team lose a lead in the 7th game.
Yeah, but what a terrific, terrific series it was. Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's get some of your thoughts in here. First of all, thoughts on word usage and language. I spoke briefly in a foreign language yesterday and then forgot to translate it. I said, let's hear it for Denlila Maniscan. Well, the phrase literally means small people in Swedish, and it's drawn a lot of attention after Swedish BP board chair Carl-Henrik Svanberg said his company cared about the small people. Una Cedar is a Harvard research assistant, and she's Swedish. So, Una, you know, Americans took that phrase, many did, as a slight, like the derogative little people. But first of all, you say it's part of a larger expression?
Well, in Swedish we have this phrase, värna om den lilla människan, and it means care for and look out for. Literally the small person, but it's a term of endearment that means that you really do look out for and care for the well-being of people in your country, and in this case, people in the Gulf.
Well, I read in the Economist language blog that it's a very affectionate term, and it's used to describe a human vulnerability to circumstances and events beyond people's control.
Yes, I think that's right. Looking out for this sense of vulnerability of regular people. I think the better expression might have been common folks, if you want to be folksy, or regular people, or really almost Joe the Plumber.
Well, my apologies for mangling it.
Oh, it's easy, and he obviously did his part to mangle it in the other direction.
Una, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, staying with word usage, many of you have noticed we're not using the word spill to describe the Gulf disaster because it's inaccurate. As Holly Hobart of Mobile, Alabama writes, at the beginning of the oil business a century ago, a release like the one in the Gulf was called a gusher, a much more realistic choice of words, not only for the quantity, but the duration. And Holly goes on to suggest another word change. People are calling the money BP will put in the escrow fund a contribution, she writes. A more accurate word is reimbursement. Maybe Here and Now could start the trend to accurately call this fund BP's reimbursement fund. We'll give that some thought. But as to reimbursement, not everyone is in favor. We spoke with Shane Guidry of Harvey Gulf International. That's the company that services deep-sea oil rigs and is now owned by the Jordan Company, a New York-based private equity firm that, among other things, manages pension funds. Well, Mr. Guidry said that the president's moratorium on new deep-sea oil drilling is hurting his business and those pension funds. He wants the president to nationalize BP to get a hold of the company's assets. Well, listener Lynn Leonardis writes, it seems that just as there are no atheists in a foxhole, there are no free market capitalists when a large company is in danger of collapsing due to its own arrogance. I'm tired of hearing how pensioners will lose their money if BP goes out of business. Shareholders of a company have a duty to ensure that they are investing in and making decisions to ensure a company's viability. Well, finally, let's get Mike Hubbard of Waukesha, Wisconsin in here because my cousins are in nearby Wauwatosa, and I love to say these towns' names. But also, Mike sends insight into this week's stunning news that Spain lost to tiny Switzerland in a World Cup match. Mike writes, The Guardian reports that Spaniards are blaming their goalie's girlfriend, a sideline sports reporter, for taking Iker Casillas' mind off the match. Her response? Nonsense. Well, that might be your response as well, but sometimes a little nonsense is in order. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us up in the right-hand corner to send an email or make a phone call. Or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. You can also tweet us. We're on Twitter at Here and Now. And by the way, you can also follow us there as we go through our morning meetings to decide what to do in our program. That's Twitter at Here and Now. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now. What if Jimi Hendrix had played the violin? It might sound like this. Daniel Bernard Romain, or DBR, often sounds like an electric guitarist. He studied music composition at Vanderbilt University and the University of Michigan, worked with dancers Bill T. Jones and Savion Glover. He has a performance this weekend with the Boston Pops and a new CD. Here's a little of the first track, Spaceships Over Haiti. Spaceships Over Haiti. It combines drums, bass, synthesizer, turntables, and DBR and his six-string violin. It's off DBR's new CD, Woodbox Beats and Balladry. Recently, he dropped by our studios with his six-string violin named Bernadette.
This was a custom-made instrument made by Eric Aceto of Ithaca Strings, upstate New York, mm-hmm. and I asked him to create something that was beautiful, both aesthetically and, of course, in its sound. And, you know, when you tour a lot, you're often alone. Mm-hmm. So every night when I'm on the road playing, I can look down and I can see Bernadette, and she's just this imaginary woman who, like a siren, you know, in the night kind of guides me
right.
through.
Well, tell us about you. We listened to Spaceships Over Haiti. We know that you were born in Skokie, Illinois, and grew up in Florida, but your parents are Haitian. So I'm just wondering, well, first of all, I'm sure you're watching the news, but where did your music come from? Is any of it particularly Haitian?
I think so. Haitian music is particularly melodic and particularly percussive, and that's essentially what I do. All of my music has always dealt with beats, and it's always had a very clear melody.
Yeah. With that in mind, tell us about the song Our Country.
Well, the first song on the track is Spaceships Over Haiti, and the last track on the album is Our Country, and it's my take on that old anthem, if you will, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And it was a way, I suppose, in some ways to kind of deal with what it means to be a Haitian American. I didn't set out to set up the tracks that way. That happened afterwards when I realized, wow, Spaceships Over Haiti, Our Country, 'Tis of Thee. I'm always self-defining myself as a Haitian American. So I think it has to do with identity and ownership. It's something that happened in a sound check with a wonderful pianist named Wynn Bennett. And she started playing this three-note figure that you hear on the recording. And My Country, 'Tis of Thee just fit over it.
By the way, for listeners who are saying, wait a second, DBR, some of them obviously know your music very well, but those who are just familiar with it might be familiar with it because you performed with Lady Gaga on American Idol.
Yes, I did.
The song Poker Face.
Yes.
What was it like performing with her?
Great. I've known her since she was 17. I met her through a mutual friend, and, you know, 6-7 years later, she had this opportunity, and she really wanted to do something that was serious and strange, as she put it. She asked me to kind of co-arrange the song.
Carry my, no, he can't read on my poker face. He's got me like nobody. Carry my, no, he can't read on my poker.
I think she's a serious student of history. So, you know, Liszt, Paganini, there's a wonderful tradition of theatricality in classical music, of course, even in pop music. I think she's along those lines of an Elton John or even a Grace Jones or even a David Bowie, of course, as she mentions, and Andy Warhol. So I think she, as a student of New York culture, is very serious and obviously has proven to be able to not only create a kind of a new music, but a new audience for it as well.
Well, and that brings us back to you, doing somewhat the same thing with the violin. Let's talk about that. You know, not the first to take violin into other areas, but tell us a little bit about what you're doing. You said you want to make your violin a wood box.
Well, it is a wood box. You know, essentially, it's a vibrating piece of wood that has, you know, steel strings and in some cases a carbon fiber bow, as I play. But it's a conversation piece for me, you know. And for a long time as a violinist, I was told, you can't play with a drum kit, can't play with the DJ. You know, you're not amplified, not loud enough. There were all these conversations that I was literally told would never happen. And of course, you know, being a precocious young person, I said no. And in saying no, I had to find a way. So the first thing I did is that I plugged in. And once you plug in a wood box and amplify it, when you strike it with the bow, it becomes animated. It becomes a wonderful sound. And of course, classical music has its own notion of extended techniques, of taking an instrument and making it do things that you wouldn't normally associate with the instrument. So that's all I'm doing. In some ways, I'm just taking the tradition of violin playing and extending it a little bit forward.
Give us, you've got the violin here, Bernadette. Give us just some examples. I mean, your classical, a taste of classical, and then how you, where you stretch. DBR with his violin. Why aren't you playing electric guitar? I mean, why the violin? If this, I mean, the sounds that you're going for are also sounds the guitarist might reach for.
Oh, absolutely. And I do play guitar, and I do play electric guitar. But I was trained as a violinist, and there are many more sounds and textures that I can do with a bow that you simply can't do with a pick. You just can't.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, as we just heard. Yeah. And by the way, can we just hear a few phrases of something straight up classical?
Sure. Sure. That was The Loss, and straight up classical to me means, well, nowadays it really means my own compositions. Uh-huh. So that's off of the CD.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Where do you think this is going, DBR? We've talked to other artists who are also performing with standard stringed instruments, maybe their guitars, but with people playing turntables and technology. Where do you think we are?
Well, you know, it's boundless. You know, I think the wonderful thing about personality and imagination is that in that sense, those things are limitless. For me, I'm moving forward by, in some ways, moving away from other instrumental musicians and really looking for those conversations with spoken word artists and dancers, filmmakers, artists who can give a different perspective on not only my violin playing, but on my compositions.
That's violinist and composer DBR Daniel Bernard Romain. His latest CD is Woodbox Beats and Balladry. DBR, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.